welcome to Be Simply. This is she, and I want to thank you all for being here today. We have special guest, Dr. Helfand. He is co-president of the Internal Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, and today he's going to share a little bit more in-depth conversation around the talk that he gave at TEDx Vail. He is going to share with us how we can do our part to help prevent nuclear war and the dangers that exist around a nuclear war. Without further ado, let's dive in with Dr. Helfand.
So, Dr. Helfand, I want to thank you so much for being here today. I really am excited about this conversation, even though it's a little ominous to discuss nuclear weapons. And first of all, I'd like to start out, if you can give the listeners a little bit of a background about yourself and your passion about ending the production and reduction of nuclear weapons here on planet Earth.
Well, you know, I've been working on this issue since the early years of Physicians for Social Responsibility. We started PSR in 1978, so it's almost 40 years ago. And my concern has always been fueled by the idea that nuclear weapons pose the greatest threat to human survival, the greatest threat to individual survival on the planet today, and that it is an urgent public health question for us to get rid of this danger. And over the years, our understanding of how great the danger posed by nuclear weapons is, our understanding of that danger has grown. We now understand that even a very limited nuclear war would be a catastrophe for the entire human race. And so there's an increasing sense of urgency about taking action to eliminate these weapons before they're used.
And if you can share with the listener from 1978 to now, what have you seen as far as reduction or increase of nuclear weapons? You know, where have we made advancements and where have we stepped backwards?
Well, you know, the great advance that we've made, and it's an important one to be aware of, is that the numbers of nuclear weapons have been reduced significantly from their Cold War peaks. We used to have nearly 70,000 nuclear warheads in the world, and in the early 1980s, the United States and the Soviet Union were really on a collision course. They were engaged in a very vigorous arms race. They were continuing to build new nuclear weapons every day, adding about 3,000 weapons each per year. Many knowledgeable experts believed that we would not survive that decade without a nuclear war. We did, but it was by the skin of our teeth. There were numerous occasions when we came within minutes of a nuclear Armageddon. And so the end of the Cold War and the dismantlement of more than 50,000 nuclear warheads is a very important step in the right direction. The problem is that there are still 15,000 nuclear warheads in the world. And whereas we used to worry only about war between the United States and the Soviet Union, we now have a world where there are 9 nuclear weapon states, and we need to worry about possible nuclear conflict between the United States and Russia, the United States and China, the United States and North Korea, India and Pakistan. There are many flashpoints in the world today, and the numbers of nuclear weapons left, although significantly reduced from the Cold War highs, are still enough to destroy the world many, many, many times over. And so we are, in a sense, in an even more dangerous situation than we were during the Cold War, because there are so many different ways that a nuclear catastrophe could engulf us.
And if you can show the listener how they can educate themselves, yet not put themselves in a level of fear that will take away from their day-to-day living and well-being.
Well, first of all, let me say, I think people should be afraid. And I know fear is a bit of a dirty word, and we're often told that we can't scare people. But the fact of the matter is, fear is a very important emotion that protects us from real dangers. Irrational fear is not good, but rational fear of something that really can harm you is appropriate. That's why we don't rush out into the street without looking, because we're afraid we'll be hit by a car. We need to be afraid of nuclear weapons. In the 1980s, millions and millions and millions of people were terrified there would be a nuclear war, and they used that fear to drive their activism. and to build a movement that stopped the arms race and that prevented nuclear war. We need to have that same level of understanding in the population today, and frankly, that same level of fear, because if we don't act, very bad things are going to happen. So it's okay for people to be afraid of nuclear war. It's not okay for people to be paralyzed by that fear, but it's critically important that they be mobilized by that fear. So in terms of how to learn more about the current situation and both the danger and also what people are doing and can do about it, there are a number of websites that are very important for people to look at. The Physicians for Social Responsibility website, www.psr.org, is one important resource. The website of our global federation, the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, www.ippnw.org, is another resource. And I would also refer people to the website for the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, the organization that has just won the Nobel Peace Prize. That website, www.icanw.org, International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. That website has some excellent information on it as well.
What have you witnessed during your time monitoring what's going on with the weapons, the different technologies that have occurred? Because I know not too long ago I was reading that Russia had supposedly misplaced 40 portable nuclear suitcase-style weapons. Are there different types of weapons that we need to be concerned about that maybe aren't recorded within any arms sanctions that be out there to be a threat that should be looked into, maybe on a state or a national level?
We know a fair amount about the arsenals of some of the nuclear weapon states. The United States and Russia are both fairly transparent, and there are treaties, most recently the New START Treaty between the United States and Russia, which allow the two countries to conduct fairly intrusive inspections in the other country's nuclear facilities to make sure that they are living up to the terms of that treaty. There is some greater uncertainty about the exact nature of the arsenals in some of the other nuclear weapon states. For example, India and Pakistan, we're not as sure how many weapons they have or where they're kept or exactly what kind of weapons they have. But in general, there is an increased need for that kind of transparency that exists currently between the United States and Russia. And as we move forward towards a new nuclear weapons convention, a treaty in which the nuclear weapons states set forth a specific timetable for eliminating their nuclear weapons, they will also need to set forth enforcement and verification procedures so that the whole world can be confident that the state parties to that treaty are in fact dismantling their weapons and are doing so in a non-reversible way, so the weapons can't be reassembled at some point in the future. And that's going to be one of the key elements of that agreement that needs to be negotiated still between the nuclear weapon states.
From your perception and objective analysis of the situation, what would you say are these nuclear nations, being the United States is one of them, is their biggest fear propelling them and inspiring them to keep such harmful weapons that could actually destroy the human race here on planet Earth?
Well, you know, I'm not sure it is a fear that propels them to keep their weapons. I think there's an element of that. But I think we need to understand that the main thing driving these countries to keep nuclear weapons is the desire to impose their will on the rest of the world. We like to think here in the United States that we just keep a nuclear arsenal in order to defend ourselves, to prevent other countries from attacking us. But in point of fact, we developed our nuclear arsenal at a time when no other country had nuclear weapons. We had built dozens of nuclear bombs before the Russians built their first. And the U.S. military has always been quite clear that a key role for these weapons is to be able to coerce the rest of the world to do what we want them to. And the rest of the nuclear weapon states, I think, have the same kind of rationale. So that's a very important first point. We need to know that these weapons are not seen just as defensive by the nuclear weapon states. They're seen as means of projecting national power. And there's a fantastic new book about this, which I would really encourage your listeners to look at, by Daniel Ellsberg. It was just released this week, and Daniel's on a national book tour about it, that talks about the genesis, the origin of the U.S. nuclear program, and how at every stage along the way, the desire to build a nuclear war fighting capability has been central to the U.S. nuclear enterprise. Mm-hmm. Now, there is also a defensive aspect to our thinking about nuclear weapons, and many people don't understand that the U.S. Holds on to its arsenal in order to be able to threaten the world, but only see the defensive aspects of this. And I think it's important to address those as well. This is the doctrine of deterrence, the notion that somehow, by possessing large nuclear arsenals, the nuclear weapon states keep each other from going to war, and that, therefore, in some way, these weapons make us safe. And it's a very powerful idea. Most of the general population who support the continued existence of a nuclear arsenal do so because they believe in this doctrine of deterrence, believe that the weapons are keeping us safe. And I think what we all need to understand is that this really isn't true. Deterrence has not prevented nuclear war. Good luck has prevented nuclear war. There have been multiple instances in which deterrence has failed, in which one of the nuclear weapon states has made the decision to launch its nuclear weapons, which is a complete abandonment of deterrence, and then turned back at the very last minute because they discovered that the threat they thought they were responding to didn't actually exist. There have been a series of these false alarms when one side or the other, Moscow or Washington, believed that it was under attack by the other country and made the decision to launch its nuclear weapons and began the preparation to do so. And at the very last minute, canceled that decision. Robert McNamara summed this up by saying, speaking about the Cuban Missile Crisis, quotes, "We lucked out. It was luck that prevented nuclear war," end quote. And we need to understand that. We have been incredibly lucky. The current U.S. nuclear policy is essentially a hope that our luck will continue. And that is not a sound basis for national security policy. Our luck will not last forever. Sooner or later, it is going to run out if we have not gotten rid of these weapons, and they will be used. And an unbelievable catastrophe will befall the human race.
And in the current Korean crisis, when you have someone appearing, I don't know him personally, a leader appearing so irrational, how do these countries really talk this person off the ledge?
I don't know much about Kim Jong-un either, but I must say I don't think he has been as irrational as he's portrayed here in the United States. I think he's made a terribly wrong decision. But basically, he's doing exactly what the United States and Russia and Britain and France and China have done. He said that nuclear weapons will make us safe. He's watched the United States destroy Iraq. He's watched the United States destroy the Gaddafi regime in Libya, both of which countries flirted with the idea of having a nuclear arsenal and decided not to have it. And he's concluded that he will be safer if he has nuclear weapons than if he doesn't, that if he has a nuclear arsenal, the U.S. won't be willing to attack him. Now, I think he's made a terribly incorrect decision here. And I think, frankly, his nuclear arsenal is the thing which puts his country at greatest risk because it's attracting the attention of the entire world. And it was a bad choice that he made. But I don't think it was irrational in the way that it is sometimes portrayed in the press here.
Right.
So how do we talk him off the ledge? I think what we try to do is what we successfully did in the 1990s. The U.S. and North Korea almost went to war in 1994. And at that time, former President Jimmy Carter traveled to North Korea with the grudging agreement of the Clinton administration, began negotiations with the North Koreans, and concluded an arrangement whereby for 8 years the North Koreans stopped their missile and nuclear programs in exchange for food and other economic aid. And we were close to coming to a final agreement with the North Koreans to formally end the Korean War, and normalize relationships between North Korea and the rest of the world. When President Bush took office in 2001, he canceled those talks and branded North Korea as part of the Axis of Evil, and the North Koreans resumed their nuclear program. So there's a model from the past of how we might succeed in diffusing this situation. It's not clear that the North Koreans will again enter into these kinds of negotiations with us. They did it once before, and they feel they were terribly burned by the United States, which they also feel continues to threaten their existence. So it's not clear that we can pull this off again, but I think that's what we need to be trying to do, to restart those negotiations. And the Russians and the Chinese have offered a framework for this. They call it a double freeze. The North Koreans would freeze their nuclear program, and the U.S. and South Koreans on their side would freeze their military exercises, which the North Koreans find so threatening. So far, the United States has not agreed to this proposal. We ought to, and we ought to push hard and hope that the North Koreans will agree to it as well. I must say, in looking at the North Korean crisis, if we're talking about irrational behavior, I am frankly much more worried about the irrational behavior coming from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. And I think this is a factor in the situation that we cannot ignore. We have a president of the United States right now who has been judged by security experts in his own party to lack the judgment, the temperament, and the knowledge base to be in command of a nuclear arsenal. Someone who has been described by the Republican chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee as living in a daycare center where he is the child and other people are looking after him. And this ought to be a cause of great concern to us. The United States has said for 30 years that it would be unacceptable for a single nuclear weapon to get into, quotes, the wrong hands, by which we meant a terrorist or a rogue state like North Korea. We've placed 6,800 nuclear weapons in the hands of Donald Trump. And that ought to be terrifying.
With this idea of keeping a country safe, you know, having an offensive and a defensive approach to weaponry, what are the alternatives outside of nuclear weapons that, you know, we could actually speak to our leaders, you know, knowing that there's all these countries that are working together to eliminate nuclear weapons, making it illegal to have them? How can we appeal to our local leaders, our senators?
I think there needs to be a national movement in this country to press for a new nuclear weapons policy. Our policy has been to depend on a large nuclear arsenal, to plan to maintain that arsenal for decades into the future, essentially indefinitely, in the hope that somehow nothing would ever go wrong and the weapons wouldn't be used. What we need to say is that that policy is insanely dangerous, that sooner or later those weapons will be used with catastrophic effects, and the U.S. needs to actively pursue a totally different nuclear policy. There is a campaign that has just been launched around the country called Back from the Brink, a call to prevent nuclear war. It is sponsored by many national religious organizations, peace organizations, and it is growing very rapidly. It calls for the United States to adopt a basic new nuclear policy predicated on 5 points: that the U.S. will not use nuclear weapons first, that the U.S. will take its weapons off hair trigger alert, that the U.S. will end the situation where any president of the United States can launch nuclear war himself or herself without any constraints on that power, that the United States stop its plans to spend well over $1 trillion enhancing every aspect of its nuclear arsenal, and fifth and most importantly, that the United States enter into negotiations with the other nuclear weapon states to conclude an agreement to dismantle the existing nuclear weapons. That should be U.S. nuclear policy. Right. And we are trying to build a movement across this country to make that U.S. nuclear policy when a new administration takes office in 2021. There's information about this on the PSR website and on the website also of the Union of Concerned Scientists. And the campaign is really just in its very early stages. There'll be a campaign website up and running hopefully within a few weeks. And we are hoping that citizens all around the country will take this simple call to prevent nuclear war to their city government, to their churches, to their labor unions, to their professional associations, and get everyone to sign on to this call so that we can build the movement in this country that we need so that when a new administration takes office in 4 years' time, that administration is truly committed to the elimination of nuclear weapons.
And to educate the listeners, we're going to put the videos here with the interview. If you can share with them how many nuclear weapons would be needed to actually destroy this planet as we know it.
I mean, I think one of the things that's very clear at this point is that a very small number of nuclear weapons will be enough to end modern civilization. We have done studies over the last 10 years based on the very important work of Alan Robach and his colleagues in the climate science community. These studies have shown that if as few as 100 small nuclear weapons were used against urban targets, and this is something that could happen in a war between India and Pakistan, for example, it would not need to involve the United States and Russia. As few as 100 nuclear weapons would cause enough worldwide climate disruption to trigger a global famine that could put up to 2 billion people at risk of starvation. This event would totally disrupt the world economy, and it would be an event unprecedented in human history in terms of the loss of life, and would almost certainly end modern civilization as we know it. No civilization in history has ever survived a shock of this magnitude, and there's no reason to think that the very complex, interrelated economic system which sustains our civilization would survive this kind of a shock. So that's 100 Hiroshima-sized bombs that would probably be enough to destroy modern civilization. There are 15,000 warheads in the world today, and most of them are 30 to 50 times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb. So there's an enormous overkill capacity in the arsenals of the world. If the United States and Russia go to war, just using the weapons which they have on high alert, the climate disruption that would follow that kind of a war would trigger essentially a new ice age. In a matter of days, temperatures would drop across the planet to the levels that were seen during the coldest point of the last ice age 18,000 years ago. All food production on the planet would stop. The vast majority of the human race would starve to death. And under those conditions, it's possible that we would become extinct as a species.
Mm-hmm. And can you share a little bit about the radioactive isotopes when you look at a smaller yet devastating incident like you in Chernobyl or in Hiroshima?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, back in the 60s and 70s and 80s, we used to think that radiation would be the main problem following a nuclear war. We now understand that the casualties caused by the fires and the explosions and the climate disruption and starvation would dwarf those. Say that radiation would not be a very significant problem. As we have seen at Hiroshima, the people who survive the explosions and fires are often exposed to very high doses of radiation, which can cause deaths in a matter of weeks to months from radiation sickness, or death years to decades later from radiation-caused cancers. There are a number of radioactive isotopes that are produced by nuclear explosions, which have very significant capacity to cause cancer. Strontium-90, which is similar to calcium, and gets incorporated into people's bones, stays with them for decades, can give rise to a number of different kinds of cancer. Cesium is very similar chemically to potassium, which is an element that's in every cell in your body. And if you're exposed to cesium-137, you take this up. It also stays in your body for a very long period of time and can cause many different cancers. Plutonium, which is one of the most problematic of the radioactive isotopes, is one of the most powerful carcinogens that we know of. It may be the most powerful carcinogen. It has an enormous capacity to produce lung cancer if it is inhaled. And plutonium has a half-life of 24,000 years, which means that it remains a threat to public health for something like a half a million years. And we've created large quantities of plutonium. This is an element which doesn't exist in nature. It's an artificial element that we've created with nuclear explosions. And we have contaminated the planet with significant amounts of this element, which will continue to plague life on this planet for hundreds of thousands of years. It's an astonishing act of ecological vandalism that we have perpetrated.
You know, we have many nuclear power plants on this planet and the United States. What threat do those pose as a weapon source, meaning someone hits those with a ballistic missile or a natural disaster, earthquake, under a fault line where a nuclear power plant has been placed?
Yeah, I think the biggest problem with the nuclear power industry is that it is so closely tied into the nuclear weapons industry. Any country that develops a nuclear power capability has essentially the ability to develop nuclear weapons. The technologies are essentially the same. And so we've seen this in both North Korea and Iran. Their nuclear programs grew out of nuclear power plants. But the plants themselves are problematic as potential sources of enormous radioactive contamination, as we saw following the Chernobyl disaster or the Fukushima disaster. And one element of the situation in Korea that does not get adequate attention is the possibility that even if nuclear weapons are not used, if there is a war on the Korean Peninsula, there are 22 nuclear reactors in South Korea which potentially could be destroyed in the fighting, or if the electric grid went down and they lost their cooling, and release enormous quantities of radiation. There are more than 50 nuclear reactors in Japan, which are also vulnerable in the event that there's war in that region. And this is a huge problem, which we have created unnecessarily for ourselves, and which we need to address. We need to get rid of these power plants and get the enormous quantities of radioactive material that we have generated at them into a safer and less vulnerable storage environment. Again, many of these isotopes are dangerous for hundreds of years, in the case of plutonium, thousands of years, and we don't have a solution to the problem of storing this very dangerous material. We need to come up with one.
And in part of the efforts with the weaponry, are the power plants addressed, or would that be a separate item that the listeners would want to take up with their local leaders?
I mean, I think that this is an issue that needs to be addressed as well. I must say that I think that the danger of nuclear war is literally orders of magnitude graver threat, and the one that we need to prioritize in many ways. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't also be actively trying to prevent the creation of new nuclear power plants, to close the power plants that exist, and to try to figure out how to store the radioactive material. It is a related and very important issue.
So, Dr. Helfand, I'd like to ask you to give the listeners a call to action. You gave a talk at TEDx Vail, and they really want to take the information you shared and inspire as many people as possible to take action in their local communities or their country.
So, you know, I think the most important thing about the nuclear danger is that, as great as it is, this is something that we can control. Nuclear weapons are not a force of nature. They're not an act of God. We have built these weapons with our own hands, and we know how to take them apart. We just need to do that. We face an incredibly grim future if we don't take action. But it is not the future that needs to be. We can make our governments do the right thing. We've done this once before. In the 1980s, a mass movement of citizens in the United States, Europe, and even in the Soviet Union changed the nuclear policies of these countries and prevented nuclear war. And we can do the same thing again. The Back from the Brink campaign, the call to prevent nuclear war, I think provides the tool that we need. And people should access this. It's available on a number of websites at this point. People can access it through the PSR website, www.psr.org, and use this tool to organize in their community to begin to build the kind of political pressure that we're going to need to fundamentally change U.S. nuclear policy. The time frame is interesting. The Freeze campaign turned U.S. nuclear policy around in about 3 years. In 1981, Ronald Reagan took office as the most hawkish president we have ever had on nuclear weapons issues. He talked frequently about fighting nuclear war, talked about conditions under which we might want to deliberately start a nuclear war, and scared the world to death. 3 years later, in January of 1984, in his State of the Union address, he said nuclear war could never be won and must never be fought. And at the time, the change was so abrupt and so complete that we didn't actually realize what had happened. We thought this was just campaign rhetoric for the 1984 presidential election, but it wasn't. We had actually changed the mind of his administration on this issue, and it just took 3 years to do it. We have to have the mindset that we are going to bring about the same kind of fundamental change in nuclear policy now, not just to stop the arms race as we did in the 80s, but to actually get rid of these weapons altogether. And this is absolutely something that we can do and something which we need to do. And I hope that everyone will join in this campaign. Again, www.psr.org. The campaign is called Back from the Brink, A Call to Prevent Nuclear War.
Dr. Helfand, I really appreciate you being steadfast with this cause since 1978. And ironically enough, this is something that's been on my mind since I was a child in the 70s. I used to talk to my dad extensively about how we can stop war, and nuclear war was something that occupied my mind as a child and still does. So thank you from my heart to yours for being steadfast, and we'll put all the links below and encourage the listeners to take action, and thank you for being here.
Well, Suzanne, thanks so much for talking with me this morning, for giving me the opportunity to talk with your listeners. I really appreciate it, and I'm very grateful. Thank you.
Once again, I want to thank Dr. Helfand and TEDxVail for being steadfast in spreading ideas and inspiring us all into action. If you are inspired by these talks and would like to do your part, please connect to the links below, and you will effortlessly see where you can sign up and be a part of a very important movement here on planet Earth. Until next time, this is She signing out with a full heart, a soft gaze, a deep bow, and a namaste. Be simply.